Think health IT, and what comes to mind? Doctors pulling up your health record at a visit, you downloading your medical information, probably with the blue button, a federal invention. Nearly all hospitals and doctor's offices use health technology in some fashion, thanks largely to a big push from the federal government. Dr. John White is the Deputy National Coordinator for Health IT, the office charged with taking the initiative to the next level. He spoke with Federal News Radio's Emily Kopp.
We have gotten to the place where adoption is widespread, and now the focus is turning to the effective use of those information tools and those information systems to improve the outcomes of care for all Americans. So that's where we're going. The way we're describing how we're going to get there is through these policy documents that you've talked about. The particular one that is of interest to us today is the Federal Health IT Strategic Plan. The strategic plan actually has existed for a while prior to the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. ONC put together federal health IT strategic plans, but starting with the passage of ARRA, which contained a significant portion of the law focused on health IT, called the Health IT or the High Tech Act, we're actually required by law to establish and promulgate the strategic plan every 5 years. So we originally did one that went from 2010 to 2015. That was the first Recovery Act mandated Federal Health IT strategic plan. And then this is the updated version. What we currently have is the updated version of the Federal Health IT strategic plan, which covers the period from 2015 to 2020.
So when you look back at that time, 2010 to 2015, health IT, e-health records, now relatively commonplace throughout the country's healthcare systems. What has been the major federal role or contribution to that?
For me, it's been a real demonstration of the power of incentives. Passed in 2009 was the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that became law, and that established an incentive program for Medicare and Medicaid providers, both ambulatory eligible providers, meaning doctors, and hospitals, eligible hospitals that cared for Medicare and Medicaid patients. And that period of time has been characterized by the power of those incentives to drive the adoption and meaningful use of health IT. That has been tremendously exciting. There have been a whole host of benefits that we've reaped from that. I think you correctly observed that there are a number of challenges that are created by that adoption. But that's what's happened over the past 5 years that's so significantly transformed the care delivery system.
What are those incentives?
Really, it's money.
It always is.
Well, there's other ways to incent people, but in this case, it was Congress established an incentive payment program where for the first period of time, going up to 2015, actually, eligible providers and eligible hospitals were paid incentives for adopting and meaningfully using health IT, in this case, electronic health records. At this point, over $28 billion has been paid to eligible hospitals and providers to incent that adoption. It is for Medicare and Medicaid providers. The programs are slightly different between the two, but not substantively enough to spend a lot of time talking about the difference between the two of them. The main thing to observe is that as of 2015 is the last year in which incentive payments will be made to Medicare providers. After 2015, there's going to be no additional money going out to providers, but there are penalties, required by the law, where if eligible providers are not adopting and meaningfully using, they will incur progressively more significant penalties to the point where I think it caps out at 5% of Medicare payments. In addition, we've been through the incentive phase, and we're starting next year on the penalty phase. So we've gone from incentives to participate to disincentives to not participate. I know you asked about the past period of time. I would also say that two other things. Medicaid providers are operating under a slightly different set of legal, slightly different legal frameworks. So there will continue to be some incentives available for Medicaid providers for the next coming years. The big game changer this year, though, was the passage of MACRA, which replaced the sustainable growth rate formula that had been dominating payment policy discussions in Congress and the administration for many years. Rolled into that new approach to paying Medicare providers is the Meaningful Use Program. It becomes part of the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, MIPS. And then further, if providers choose not to want a different way to participate in the Medicare program and not do MIPS, they can participate in alternative payment models, or APMs. And one of the statutory requirements to participate in an advanced payment model is the use of certified health IT. So you know, the incentive program has brought us up through 2015 and we'll work with for the next couple of years. But then starting in 2019, we entered, for Medicare providers, the world of MACRA, and health IT will continue in that for the foreseeable future.
The ideal government incentive program or incubator is something where the government needs to put in the resources in the beginning, but then the marketplace takes over and this just becomes the norm of business. Do you see that happening with health IT and the healthcare system?
Absolutely. We were starting to see it at the end of the 2000s, especially amongst, for example, large provider, multi-specialty provider groups. The adoption rate was a lot higher at that time for those groups than it was for, perhaps hospitals or for smaller eligible provider organizations. Because what they found was they needed those systems to be able to manage their information efficiently and to be able to handle their other information needs like scheduling or revenue cycle or what have you. The incentive program came along at the right time for those smaller providers as well as hospitals, and that's where you see the really dramatic uptick in adoption rates. Now that we're on the other side of those resources, you know, we have a robust dialogue with care providers, including professional organizations representing physicians, professional organizations representing hospitals, professional organizations representing nurses. And, you know, although we have some differences over the specifics of some of the programs, pretty uniformly, they all say to us, you know, we all know and recognize that we need these systems to be able to deliver great care. We need good information tools and good information systems to be able to do what we all went into medicine and healthcare to do, which is take care of people. So, yeah, I do think that we're seeing that, and not just from the clinical side, but from the business side as well. I think that the people who are running the business of healthcare also recognize that they really need those information systems, especially when they start thinking about participating in alternative payment models or different approaches to value-based purchasing. They've got to be able to manage their information, and they've got to be able to exchange information with each other. So I think that the incentive program did what it was supposed to do. It drove adoption, and it got our providers thinking about how they are meaningfully using those systems. And now, as the reimbursement model is changing, that recognition is there that they need to keep using these systems to be able to substantively and effectively participate in those payment models.
Emily Kopp asked White about one of the biggest challenges federal health IT officials have to solve, the interoperability between the Defense Department and the Veterans Affairs Department.
Interoperability has been really challenging. And honestly, it's not just been for the DOD and the VA. You go to any large healthcare provider around the country and some of our leading lights, and I'm not going to name names, but if you say to them, so, how have things been going with interoperability? And you actually get down, drill down into the specifics of what data is going and where is it going and who has access to it, when do they have access to it, and why do they have access to it? It's challenging. And part of the reason for the challenge is that it's really easy to say the word interoperability, and everybody kind of, says, yeah, that sounds right. We should have interoperability. when you get down to the details, interoperability means different things for different situations with different people. And this is also not just the kind of information that you can kind of, you know, put out there on a bulletin board, right, and have everybody have access to. This is really sensitive information about people's lives and their health, and perhaps that of their families and loved ones as well. So it's got to be treated with appropriate respect and care, and frankly, sometimes legal constraints. So there's rules associated with who can get access to the data, when they can get access to it, and that sort of thing. Okay. So there are challenges to dealing with interoperability, and I could talk to you for a long time if you want about interoperability. We've got a whole roadmap around it. But you know, the final thing that I think I would say is that although there have been challenges to exchanging information between DoD and the VA, you know, sometimes that perception overwhelms the reality that there is a lot of data that gets shared for good reasons, back and forth between the DoD and the VA. And that's been increasing pretty substantially over the past several years. There's been a very focused effort, shared effort between the DoD and the VA to establish better interoperability between their systems and their records. Very recently, in the past couple months, DoD has made a significant acquisition of new technology that is the way they've got their acquisition structured. It's been a real pleasure working with Chris Miller and his colleagues over at the DoD. Interoperability is at the heart of that, and that is really going to drive forward information sharing for the benefit of our service members and our veterans. So, to try to encapsulate what we've said, I think that there's good work that's happened. I think there's been challenges, but we're in a good place, and I think it's going to get increasingly a lot better as we move along through the next couple of years.
VA's new plan for treating veterans really relies on closer coordination with the outside healthcare system. So this does seem to be a problem at the heart of this, in that two doctors in different systems need very close contact with each other. And so this interoperability problem has to be solved. In your strategy, how do we get out of this?
So the key thing to understand about interoperability and what you just observed, okay, but about interoperability between the VA and private providers, is that this is status quo that is getting increasing recognition. Okay, it's not new for veterans to be in the Veterans Administration health system and to see their private providers. This has been going on for as long as there's been a VA. So that part's not new. It also happens with what might be to some people surprising frequency in the Department of Defense health system. TRICARE certainly has a wonderful organization, but a lot of service members all and their families also get care outside of the DoD system specifically. So there's historically been a really strong need for information to be able to flow back and forth between the private sector and the public sector. Looking across the private sector, I'll say that we've made great strides, but the private sector has not completely solved the interoperability issue themselves either. So we've taken a really good hard look at the issue over the past year and a half. We mentioned before that the past 5 years have been about spurring adoption of information systems and health information technology. And we recognize that the next step on that path is driving forward the interoperability of these systems with each other. And what we came to is a pretty clear recognition is that there are really important things that we can and should and will do as the federal government. But just as important are our partners in the private sector, okay, that are really critical to drive this forward. As significant a role as the federal government plays in all this, we cannot do it without the private sector. And that led us to develop our interoperability roadmap, which lays out not just federal commitments and actions, but calls to action in the private sector that need to happen for us to get to interoperable information systems that support the learning health system that we all want to get us to the better outcomes that we need. I think that interoperability is key for us to get to that better place. And there's things that we're going to do in the government, but there's things that the private sector is, frankly, ready, willing, and been able to partner with us to do. One of the joys of developing the roadmap has been deep engagement with the private sector, and in both the drafting and development of the final roadmap, and seeing the folks in the private sector saying, "Yeah, we're willing to step up to the table, and we're willing to work together to get to that more interoperable system."
So what's the, it sounds like you have willing partners on both the federal and non-federal side. What's the holdup? Is it money? Is it technology that hasn't been invented yet?
Well, so there's a couple of different components to the holdup. Okay. So there is a technical piece of it. We have a lot of the pieces in place, but getting both agreement on the technical standards and implementation specifications, okay, that get used for our information systems, as well as doing some additional information work or additional development work on new technical standards and approaches to sharing of information. That is, those are things that have got to happen. It's pretty clearly laid out in the roadmap that we are looking to utilize and improve our technical standards and implementation guidance. That means that both pointing to current best standards that are available that people ought to be using and being specific about the ways in which they implement them, as well as trying to take a look at newer or at least different technical approaches to sharing of information like application programming interfaces or APIs, which we don't think are going to be the solution to absolutely everything for interoperability, but we think represents a really important technical step forward from where our current information systems are. And this is something that we put not just in our policy documents like the interoperability roadmap, but that we've included in our regulatory actions like our 2015 edition certification rule, and are also included in the most recent incentive program rule, which is more commonly referred to as meaningful use. So there's a technical piece to it. There is an incentive piece to this. We saw the power of incentives to drive adoption, and we are also firm believers in the power of incentives and payment models to drive interoperability. So we've been working very closely with our colleagues in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and other federal payers to align their rules and their policies regarding interoperability and how that's inculcated into the payment rules. What you see in initiatives like value-based purchasing, which is part of the Secretary's delivery system reform initiative, is that those value-based payment arrangements include provisions for the use of technology and include requirements for interoperability. There is another component to achieving interoperability, which comes down to aligning federal and state privacy and security requirements. You talked about different obstacles to interoperability, and one of those is a common understanding and a common practice of how we treat privacy and security.
As somebody who's a patient, you know, we wonder about where our information is going, and we only have to look at recent episodes of the breaches of OPM databases to find out when things go wrong, there is no fix, right? I mean, your information is out there and there's no remedy for it. So this is a highly sensitive barrier, right, to solve.
Sometimes it can be a barrier, and sometimes it doesn't have to be a barrier. So here's let me talk a little bit about what I mean by that. I talked earlier about how the fact that this is not just information that you can post up on the bulletin board or set out pamphlets with your medical record. That's not how people want their health information treated, and that's not how we should be treating it, quite frankly. And there are laws and rules in place. We all know about HIPAA, but there are a number of state policies and state regulations that also impact the privacy and security of health information. You correctly identify several high-profile incidences of cybersecurity or issues with cybersecurity, sometimes around health information systems, but largely around other types of systems is what's been in the news of late. And let me tell you, we take that really seriously. We've got provisions in our new rule that significantly advance requirements for certified systems in relation to privacy and security. CMS's incentive rule that was just finalized. There are requirements for providers to be a lot more rigorous in how they approach security because, you know, keep in mind, again, that the what we're currently working with is an incentive program. We can require technology developers who get certified to do certain things, but that doesn't mean we can make all technology developers do that. In the same way, CMS can incent providers to take these steps to improve the security of their systems and address privacy concerns with their systems, but we can't make them do that. We can only incent them to do that under the, you know, the current construct. So we work very closely with our colleagues also in the Office of Civil Rights. These are the folks who administer HIPAA and the privacy rule, and also colleagues across the federal government and the private sector. We've got robust activity in our federal advisory committees that give us ongoing feedback on our approaches to privacy and security, and we try to incorporate that in our programs as well. So the bottom line is it's really important. Sometimes it presents an obstacle, and sometimes it doesn't have to present an obstacle, but better education about what the rules actually are and about how you appropriately use the technology, we think is the path to getting to a better place there.
John White is the Deputy National Coordinator for Health IT, speaking with Federal News Radio's Emily Kopp. Share this interview with your colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive and click share with friends.